Good morning. My name is Aideen McGarry and I'm a senior associate in the Kingsley Napoli clinical negligence team. Our team specialise in bringing claims relating to brain injuries, including where these have been suffered by babies during or following birth. Today I'm joined by Penny Harger, who is a relationship officer at the charity PEEPS HIE, which supports those affected by HIE, which is where there's a lack of oxygen and blood flow to the brain, which can lead to brain injury. Penny's going to talk about HIE in some more detail and discuss the support available to those affected. Thanks so much for joining me today, Penny. So can you tell me first a bit about you and how you became involved with the charity PEEPS?
Yep, so my name's Penny. I am 38 years old. We had our eldest daughter, Jess. She's nearly eight, so nearly 8 years ago. She was a full-term baby. I was induced, and unfortunately she had a sudden neonatal collapse at around 40 minutes old, and that is how we became involved in the world of HIE. So as a result of her collapse, she was a HIE grade 3, and then she had a massive seizure. She had cooling treatment, which we can talk about a bit later as well. And then while she was being warmed up, they discovered that she also had meningitis. At the time, because this was nearly 8 years ago, there wasn't any support available for HIE families. There just wasn't anything. Bliss was one of the main charities that provide support for families, but they struggled a little bit because we didn't really fit into any of their categories as such. So they helped us as much as they could. But there just wasn't an awful lot around for full-time parents, especially those who suddenly were thrust into a world of potentially fairly catastrophic brain damage. And then PEEPS became a registered charity back in 2018, which suddenly Jess, our daughter, and lots of her friends and who are also HIE babies, we all discovered the charity at the same time. So we all registered at the same time. And then last year there was a role that came up. I applied for it and now I work for PEEPS as well as their relationships officer. So we've been in the world of HIE for nearly eight years. And we've been living the daily life of a HIE family since then.
Okay, so when you say that your daughter suffered a collapse shortly after birth, can you explain a bit more to someone who might not be familiar about what exactly HIE is and what are some of the causes of it, and obviously in your daughter's case?
Yep, so if I go through the general terms first and then I'll go into a little bit more detail about Jess. So there's lots of different reasons for HIE. As you said before, it's a disruption or a lack of blood flow and oxygen to the brain. This could be because there's something wrong with the placenta, there's a difficulty with blood pressures, there's low oxygen levels in the mom, there's a problem with the umbilical cord, there could be infection, or from the other kind of side of things, negligence, error. None of it would be intentional, but sadly sometimes things do happen during labour and delivery where potentially it could have been prevented. Sometimes it's things like a skull being crushed, or seeing that the baby's obs were dropping quite rapidly enough in time, they didn't pick it up quick enough, things like that. There's just so many different reasons for HIE. The clinical guidelines, once HIE has been determined, there are different grades. So there's grades 1, 2, and 3. If it's a grade 1 collapse, they just monitor the baby. If it's grade 2 or 3, they do what they call cooling treatment. So that's where the baby is. It's usually across the whole body, not always. Sometimes they target a specific area, but usually it's the whole body is wrapped in a, for making it a simple way, it's a bubble wraps suit that has cold water running through it that drops the body temperature to around, 33 degrees. And they drop that body temperature to give the brain the best chance of recovery or maintaining as it is instead of further damage being created. So they drop the body temperature for between 48 and 72 hours, usually 72 hours. Then they have to gradually rewarm the baby. Once the baby's been warmed, that's generally when you tend to see if there are kind of ongoing effects from the HIE event itself. So in our personal circumstances, they believe that I would have been group B strep positive, but we don't test for it in the UK. So I'm quite a complicated case because there's actually lots of different factors that have caused Jess's brain damage. So they assume that I was group B strep positive. She had a sudden neonatal collapse, though. Her colour was really grey. She wasn't getting enough oxygen. She had a big seizure. She needed resuscitation. She needed a blood transfusion because her oxygen levels were so low. There just wasn't enough in the bloodstream to keep her alive. They took her away to the neonatal unit, obviously, to do all of these things to her. So at that point, I was no longer with her. So all of this is kind of what I was told was happening in retrospect. She had her cooling suit put on. She was cooled whilst they were waking her up. She wasn't responding properly. So they did a lumbar puncture, which is where they take some of the cerebral spinal fluid from the spinal column. And they check to see if there's any infection markers. Jess had really high infection markers. So she had meningitis. At the time, unfortunately, because the infection markers were so high, she had what they call hydrocephalus. So the fluid wasn't draining properly from her brain. So although she had a huge seizure, which caused a certain amount of brain damage, the ventricles from inside the middle of her brain were then squashing the brain against her skull. So she had further brain damage as a result of that hydrocephalus. We're very lucky in some respects because they managed to get the antibiotics sorted fairly quickly, working out which ones reacted to her particular infection. So the hydrocephalus at that point went away on its own. They continue to do things like cranial ultrasounds, which is they use like a pregnancy ultrasound, but they use it on the top of the head so that they can see what's happening inside the brain. And they do that, I believe they do that to most of the babies receiving cooling treatment, just as a way of seeing how their brain is functioning. They can also do things like put electrodes on the brain so they can actually monitor the brain function whilst the baby's been sedated as well. So all of these things, whilst the baby's cooled, the baby's sedated. So you can't feed them, you can't breastfeed them. There's no bottle feeding. It's really difficult to hold the baby because they're sedated and they're in their little bubble wrap suit. So it's not always safe enough to hold them because they are obviously in intensive care. So that's kind of a general overview of what happens. The other thing to note is that for HIE, cooling is currently the only treatment available. So there isn't really any other option. If your baby is the grade one, then you don't need the cooling treatment. They'll monitor. Grade two and three, cooling treatment is pretty much the only way forward. And then it's when they're being warmed up that's when you can see whether or not there is permanent brain damage or not.
Okay. So as you said, Jess is kind of HIE, lack of oxygen and blood flow to her brain, that was as a result of a seizure, which was following on from an infection, and also meningitis, which is, as you said, quite a unique situation, because often what we see when we act for children who suffer from HIE is delays in delivery or errors involving babies who were born naturally, who perhaps should have been born by a cesarean section, things like that. So
yeah,
thanks for sharing that. That's really, really interesting. I can't imagine what a stressful and traumatic
time. Yeah, it's not the start to family life that you expect, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Particularly when you were mentioning that obviously you were talked about the cooling treatment, and that I understand has to happen fairly rapidly.
Yeah, so the optimum time for cooling treatment to start taking place is within 6 hours of the event. So there's a fairly, I mean, 6 hours, it sounds like a long time, but actually at that moment, 6 hours is not a very long time to try and get that cooling treatment sorted out, because the other thing to bear in mind is that not every neonatal unit can do the cooling treatment. Only, I may have this wrong, but I believe it's only a level three unit that can actually do the cooling treatment. So other units it can be started on, but their baby will then be transferred to a different hospital, which is a level three or above, for their cooling treatment and their care. They can then be transferred back again once the cooling treatment's finished, but it all depends on at that point on how the baby's managing, because obviously they have to be safe enough to be transferred back and things like that. So in our case, and for a lot of the families that we help at PEEPS, we're all in the same situation where we've had our babies and then they've had to not only be taken away to the special care unit, but they've actually been transferred to a completely different hospital, which can be quite a distance away, because it depends on where the nearest intensive care cot is, which isn't always the closest level three unit. So there are things being done to make level two neonatal care units be able to do the cooling treatment, but that's not the standard practice at the moment, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, so I can imagine that's quite difficult. Very difficult in a time when obviously you're expecting to be close to your baby, bonding with your baby, and not only do they have this horrific thing happening to them, but you can't necessarily be with them while they're having this really important treatment. So I can't imagine how stressful that must be. At what stage for you did you start to get some external support? I mean, obviously not from the medical staff, but what support was available for you, and when did you first come into contact with that?
So we were very lucky. The neonatal units that Jess was on, because she was on two different neonatal units, from the one she was born at and then the one she was transferred to. And then we did go back to the one that she was born at after her intensive care, once she was stepped down to high dependency, and then back to just normal special care. Once she reached that point, we were transferred back to our local hospital special care unit. They were really good. We had Bliss volunteers that went into those particular trusts. Again, not every hospital has the Bliss volunteers that will go, that are able to go into the units, because it just depends on where they're available. We were given the Bliss contact details fairly early on. We didn't actually need to really contact them until a few weeks after discharge, but we were slightly different. So Jess's complications, so her diagnoses now are cerebral palsy, epilepsy, hydrocephalus with a VP shunt, because sadly at 2.5 she became very unwell again, and the meningitis called scar tissue to build up, which caused the hydrocephalus to come back, and she had to have a shunt inserted. So that's neurological surgery to insert a needle with a tube attached, which drains the excess fluid away, and she has to have that forever now. So she has hydrocephalus with a VP shunt and global delay. At the time after discharge, we didn't have things like tracheostomies or feeding tubes or any oxygen or medical devices and things like that. So our actual need for support at that point was fairly low. It was only when we were having difficulties with her feeding and things like that that I really needed the support. It's more the, for us, it was more the emotional support. A lot of people don't understand, because you can't understand how difficult it is once you've lived through something like that, just to be able to leave the house, because it's obviously a very traumatic experience that you've lived through. When you attend things like baby groups and things like that, your baby doesn't reach any of the milestones when the other babies do. Quite often you have to explain to other parents why your baby's not doing the same things that their ones are. So Jess wasn't able to hold her head until she was nearly 9 months old. She didn't crawl till she was about 14 or 15 months old. She took her first steps at 3.5. All of those things are very delayed, but we're actually very lucky, because a lot of the HIE babies, they are just not able to do any of those things, and they unlikely ever will. there's also very sadly the other side of things where not all HIE babies actually survive. So there's a lot of bereavement issues around HIE as well, which needs to be taken into consideration. It's just a very complicated condition that can cause any number of outcomes, any number of disabilities, and the support generally needs to be available when you need it. So some families, they get a lot of support from things like continuing care or the palliative care teams fairly early on, but that's because their children have very complex medical needs. They need a lot of kind of nursing support, that kind of thing. Not all families need that. So the support that's there, it just depends on as and when you as a family need it. And there are things that are accessible to you, like the palliative care and the continuing care, but sometimes it's hard to find out about those things as well. If you're not told about them and you're not referred, then you just don't know that they exist. You're not used to having to do all of these things that you'd never dreamed that you'd have to be doing. So things like feeding through an NG tube and nasogastric tube, which goes through the nose down into the stomach. You have to be taught how to do those things. So when you become a mum, you kind of think you'll either breastfeed or you'll need to learn, you know, teach the baby how to take a bottle and things like that. But actually, it could be that you as a parent end up having to be taught by nursing staff how to check that the NG tube's potentially in the right place. There's all sorts of other things around that. And then, you know, actually feeding through the NG tube, there's a lot of issues with reflux and things like that. So actually leaving the house can be really difficult. And those are the times where you really need the support from either NHS services or people like PEEPS to say it's okay that you are struggling to leave the house. There's lots of our families who are in the same situation. We do some virtual sessions and things like that. Some of the children's centres, particularly during COVID, a lot of their things went virtual, which actually a lot of our families found quite helpful because everybody was doing things virtually. They weren't the only ones trying to do baby massage through a virtual session. And some of them found that quite beneficial.
Okay. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the other support that PEEP offers to HIE parents?
Yeah, so we've got all sorts of different support available. So we offer a one-to-one peer support. So all of our volunteers have lived experience of HIE. So they're either a parent or a carer or a grandparent of a HIE baby. We have our website, which has got information, and we've got different signposting and things on there to potentially other organisations or charities that might be able to help. We hold monthly online coffee mornings, and we do monthly online free infant massage, which is always quite popular. We have specific Facebook pages for our older children called Little HIE Rose, Little Heroes. That's a private Facebook group, so it's somewhere safe for those families with older children to be able to talk about the difficulties that they're going through at the moment. There's a separate dads hub, which again is a private Facebook group just for the dads. There's a closed Facebook group for bereaved families. Like I said earlier, unfortunately not all HIE babies manage to survive, so we have a separate bereavement group for those. We hold in-person events throughout the year, which are called our PEEPS Together events. They're held across the UK. We do information sessions, though, things like understanding trauma, support for siblings, advanced care plans and things like that. And then we also have our financial support that we can help with. So the HIE experience that you go through is obviously incredibly traumatic, and to access counselling and things like that through the NHS, it's a complete postcode lottery, as it is everywhere. Somewhere waiting lists are not too long, somewhere they're up to 2 years. We can arrange and fund counselling generally within a few days once we've found a counsellor, and we will pay for those sessions. We do equipment funding of up to £500, which is needs and not means tested. Lots of charities are means tested, and we're quite proud of the fact that we base it on the child's need. We can also have the bereavement family fund, which is called Sully's Fund, and that we can help put towards funeral costs or whatever it is that the family of a bereaved family would request. We can help them with some financial support if they need it. So they're some of the things that we do to support. And then we ran our first Peeps Together weekend last year, which is where we had, I believe it was 14 families, come all HIE families come together for kind of an activity weekend. It is fully kitted out for them, so it had the changing places, all of the different activities were completely accessible. So they did things like canoeing, abseiling, things that you would not necessarily expect a fully wheelchair bound person to be able to participate in. We managed to run a weekend at the Brendrick Trust for those families, which they found really beneficial, so we're hoping to run another one of those this year.
Wow, that sounds amazing, and I can imagine the kind of support even from a community of people who are going through the same thing, have lived the same experience, is just massively beneficial to anyone who's going through what you went through yourself.
We do have a closed WhatsApp group, which is incredibly popular. It pings off all hours of the night. So if any of the families are going through something, or they've got some testing, or they've had to be readmitted, or they just want to chat with other HIE families, there is a WhatsApp group that they can join, where they can just talk to other families who understand the difficulties of what you're going through when you're potentially having to fight for a piece of equipment or a second piece of equipment, or just talking about different feeding methods, or somebody's got this type of syringe, has anybody seen what the end of it looks like, anything like that they talk about on there, which a lot of our families found really popular as a support system.
That sounds amazing. One thing that did occur to me while you were speaking is there anything that if you could go back now, 8 years ago, when you were starting out on this journey, is there anything you would have wanted to know or would want to say to yourself that you know now that you didn't know back then that might be helpful for someone else who's starting out on this journey?
I think for us, because there wasn't any support available, it was a very lonely place. Once we were discharged and we came home, that's often when families and friends really struggle to understand that there are ongoing problems. Because you've been discharged and you're back at home, everybody thinks that, well, you're well, the baby's home, so it's all fine. They don't really understand that it is great that you're home, but actually you've got a million hospital appointments and 16,000 hours of admin to do. And, you know, every year the same sort of documents have to be filled out, and trying to find places that you can take your children to that are accessible. All of these things are really difficult. So if I was going back to myself then, I would just like to tell myself that I would get through it. Days are really difficult. Some days are really good. Some days are really bad. It all depends on how she is and whether she's well. When she's not well, I tend to not cope as well as I do on the days that she's good. When she's admitted in hospital, I honestly really struggle. And I would go back to myself and say, it's okay to not be okay on those days, and to ask for help and support. Obviously now things are slightly different because the charity is there, people do have somewhere to go, so it's more signposting those families at the earliest appropriate opportunity to say, here are some places that you can go to for help when you're ready, because it all depends on that individual, and they need to be ready to go out and meet the world and be prepared for those things. There's no point in pushing a family if they're not ready because it's a very stressful, difficult time of your life that actually will take you months, if not years, to get over. And you never really do get over it. You still feel guilty, even though there's nothing you could have done. That guilt will never, ever go away. It just won't.
And what's the best place for people to find Peeps, Penny?
So we have, I'm going to put you on the spot now. So we've obviously got all of our contact details on our website. We're available on Facebook. We are on X or Twitter. So our website is www.peeps-hie.org. We've got our contact phone numbers on there. So the number is 0800 987 5422. And on Facebook, if you search for Peeps-hie, we'll show up there. If you go to the website, all of our social media details are on there. So you can access them as and when you want to, including our family leaflets. They're all available to download. So you can have a look at any of our information on that website.
Thanks so much. Was there anything else that you wanted to speak about that I haven't touched upon that you think might be helpful?
Our personal situation is different to a lot of the families that will be coming to you, because we are the more complicated end of the spectrum regarding the actual HIE event itself anyway. Yeah. There's lots of contributing factors for our personal circumstances. The families that come to you, exactly what caused it? Was it the meningitis that caused it, or was that, and then the meningitis was a byproduct? Was she GBS positive? There's just too many variables for our circumstances. The families that come to you, the ones that negligence has been an attributing factor, it must be so much harder for them to know that something happened or something someone did is the reason that their child has these difficulties. Or maybe they don't have any difficulties, but they still went through that traumatic process. So the support that they need, things like our WhatsApp group, a lot of the families on there have, it's that side of things rather than me, where there's not really anything can be attributed. So those families, they actually find it really beneficial to be on that WhatsApp group and to talk about things, because it was in the best way, it was something that was done to them rather than that just happened like me. So it's very difficult. Yeah. And I can't imagine some of the stories that you guys come across from a negligence point of view. I couldn't do what you do.
And that, well, thanks so much. I think, yeah, as you said, obviously someone in your situation is different to someone who might be wanting to pursue a clinical negligence case in terms of the cause of the HIE, but I think where your insights are so helpful and important is just in terms of the next step, in terms of living with HIE.
Yeah, I mean, the actual processes and what's available and all that kind of thing is the same. It's literally
in a way, it's relevant. Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of different. And the other thing to bear in mind is that HIE is never talked about during pregnancy. It's just not one of those things. So everybody talks about T21 or Down syndrome, and everybody talks about, potential genetic conditions, the standard genetic conditions that are tested for and things like that. But HIE is just never mentioned throughout pregnancy. Like GBS is never mentioned throughout pregnancy at all. But actually, the rates of HIE are gauged somewhere between 3 and 4, which is actually the same as T21 or Down syndrome. It's just that HIE is never talked about. So when you actually look at those figures, the number of HIE babies is the same as the number of Down syndrome babies that are identified. It's just that you don't know about it. So again, not always, but most T21 babies are picked up during pregnancy. and then the family can make a decision. But I'm still now, nearly 8 years later, still asked if I knew that she was going to have cerebral palsy when I was pregnant. And funnily enough, the answer is no, because it was a fairly horrific birth circumstance that happened. These families that are coming to you, the same things, they will be asked by people all the time. And it just gets progressively harder and harder to live with that the older the child gets and things. So it's the figures that probably stand out quite a lot is actually the same number of, if you compare the two conditions in a figures point of view, they're the same. It's just that everybody's heard of Down syndrome and T21 and nobody's heard of HIE unless it's happened to you.
Absolutely. Maybe because of the association with kind of negligence and error in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
But that is true. That's really interesting. And I can imagine that brings a whole another level of kind of questions and explanations that you have to go through all the time with people, which must be really, really frustrating. I can totally imagine.
Yeah, I mean, to
that.
Me, it's not just, you know, healthcare professionals, every time we get a new healthcare professional, every time we go into A&E, if it's somebody new that we've not seen before, they still need to go through the whole history again. So you just get used to talking about it and just going through it from a very clinical point of view. From the emotional point of view, I don't particularly like discussing it. It's very difficult for me to talk about the actual ins and outs. So I can talk about it from a clinical point of view, but if you actually ask me what it was like going through at the time, I mean, I don't like talking about it. I don't like reliving it. It's far too stressful. So
completely understandable. Thanks so much for joining us today, Penny, and sharing some really personal and incredibly helpful insights with us. I'm sure they'll be endlessly helpful to anyone who is finding themselves in a similar situation to you 8 years ago. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me do this little podcast today.
Oh, genuinely, thanks so much, because it's really helpful even to know from our side how, you know, what people are going through and how we can best support them. Obviously, we can only deal with compensation and money, but I think you were saying, you know, lawyers need to be really kind of emotionally attuned to all the issues that HIE parents are dealing with. So it is really, really helpful and important to hear from your side of the fence, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, whenever we're dealing with people, either like yourself or healthcare professionals, some of the educational workers, so, you know, we never expect anybody to really understand what it is that we've been through, but just having that empathy is one of the most important things. And when families are coming to you for support, it's so important that you say, you know, we don't know what you've been through, but we're going to try and help. That's the most honest and open thing you could possibly say. And that would be far more appreciated than saying, well, you know, we're going to go with this and we're going to manage to help you get some compensation and things like that. Because it is about the finances, but it's not actually about the finances. It's about financial security for the child going forward, because some of these children, their care and their needs are going to be so great that although the NHS will provide for it, all the time we're here as parents to advocate for them is absolutely fine. But the worry that you have as a parent is when you're not here, or if you're not able to advocate for your child, what happens to them at that point? So the reason that families mostly come to you is to make sure that if it's appropriate, that the trusts are held accountable for what happened, but also to help provide financial security for that child for potentially when the parents or the carers are no longer around to help make decisions for that child. If they've got some money in a trust or something now, they can get all the trustees and everything sorted out for that eventuality if that happens. So it's more about the financial security than actual money as such, because nothing's gonna magically make your child better.
I mean, it's about addressing the child's needs and putting them insofar as possible in the best possible position for the future.
So,
Thanks so much.